The root of any truth is embedded in our souls. Naming this nameless must be translated through the ages so it can not only be heard but recognized as truth once again. The Tao Te Ching is one of these writings, originally sung through the ages. Scholar Rosemary Anderson's latest book, The Divine Feminine Tao Te Ching, is nourishing us today as we move forward and inward. I'm Robin with Tributaries. Rosemary, before we move into your translation of the Tao Te Ching, I'd like to ask, does the original authorship continue to be shrouded in mystery, and are there many theories as to its origin? I mean, it must have been passed down for quite a while orally.
Yeah, that's a good way to begin, because as far as scholars know, they can trace the oral tradition back to the 11th century BCE, and that's based on linguistic analysis. However, the written text did not start to be collected in various parts of China, central China, until the late 2nd century, maybe the end of the beginning of the 3rd century. So there was probably a very long oral history.
And so what about the original authorship?
Oh, the authorship, right. Well, we don't really know who wrote it. Lao Tzu means old master. It's a title, not a name.
Not everyone knows that.
No, it's just it's a title, like the reverend in our time.
Gotcha.
So it's not a name. So there may have been many old masters, and at a certain point, people started writing down all these wonderful sayings and attributed them to an old master, and there may have been many. My idea is that there probably were many, and they were just given an honorific title, like old masters. And there are theories, of course, about who any one of these people might be, but it's contested.
You've read many copies of the Tao off of silk fabrics and bamboo slips. Where were these copies? Was it difficult to find them or get permission to study them?
Yeah, well, they were written on bamboo strips probably initially, and then onto silk. Silk, as you may or may not know, I was a seamstress for a while. It is a very robust fabric, and especially in its more raw form, and then buried in tombs, and then the tombs were sealed with gas, typically combustible gas. And so many of these findings have been discovered by archaeologists and sometimes by grave robbers, and that leads to all kinds of challenges.
Sure. Where did you find the copies that you were able to actually study, and was it difficult to find?
No.
Or to get permission, I should say.
No. At this point, it's all a matter of public record. There are literal translations now available, character by character translations. So I could use those to be able to read the Chinese text that I don't know, the Chinese characters that I don't know.
So, I'm sorry, you said you don't know the Chinese characters?
Well, I know a lot of Chinese, basic Chinese, from my time in Asia and then from studying along the years. But there were characters in the original text that I didn't know, and that I depended on the scholars for. So they filled in my knowledge.
Sure.
But basically, I can read basic Chinese, although it comes and goes in a way.
Of course.
Because I don't use it every day.
Yeah. It must have been quite a fun adventure, though, discovering what these characters were. And then once you found out their meaning, I'm sure you could just look into the actual character itself and see, oh, yeah, of course that's what it means.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was a great process of discovery as I discovered and looked into the etymology of many of these characters. It was revelatory, really.
Mm. And you write that there's a genius to the creation of the written Chinese language, which are these characters. How do you see that?
Well, I've had this feeling about Chinese ever since I lived in Asia in the late 70s. there's a depth to Chinese characters. Each character, for example, is somewhat like a photograph or a short video. So when you're reading a sentence written in Chinese, the characters are both kind of visual and auditory at the same time. You're literally watching a video, whether you're in the subway station or reading the Tao Te Ching.
Can you give an example of a specific character and tell us about it in that way?
Sure. For example, the character for peace, just peace, is formed of two simplified characters called radicals. And the top radical means roof, and under the roof is a woman, the character for woman. And for the Chinese, when women were under a roof, that meant there was peace in the land.
Mm.
It's quite beautiful, actually.
It's so beautiful, yes. My understanding of the characters and the very few characters that I'm aware of is just so beautiful. However, when you started talking about it and you said radical, I thought, yeah, peace is a pretty radical idea these days.
Yeah. The simplified characters are just called radicals. That's the English term, anyway. And then they're assembled into, you know, more complex characters. And, you know, now modern Chinese is more made up, really. But the ancient Chinese that was used to transcribe the Tao Te Ching was much more basic and etymologically clear.
Right, yes. I know whenever I hear Hebrew, I don't have a clue about what they're saying, but there's such a depth that you can just feel in the language for its meaning.
Yes, I studied Hebrew when I was in seminary, and that was my experience of Hebrew, too. These old languages that have ancient origins are often much more sophisticated in some way than modern languages.
Yes, yes, more potent for sure. And is there something about the etymology or of the Chinese characters themselves that play into how relevant the Tao is today, centuries later?
That's an interesting question. What I would say is that the way the Chinese characters are arranged is inherently poetic, often, not always, but often very poetic. And so they are able, in combination, to point to esoteric meanings because they're kind of metaphoric, naturally metaphoric, and then they point to esoteric, mystical meanings that would be very difficult to do without this poetic quality to the language. Yeah, it's interesting. We look at a phrase like Wei Wu Wei, which is used throughout the Tao Te Ching.
And it's also my next question.
I see. That's interesting. Well, Wei Wu Wei literally means do without doing, or know without knowing. I mean, it's variously translated, or it can be do nothing, emptiness. You know, it's like you can translate it a whole lot of ways. It's usually translated do without doing or
right.
Act without acting.
Yes. Now, I was going to ask you actually about that and how that essential lesson of that unsuspectingly entered your life, it seemed, after reading your book.
Mm-hmm.
How did you experience that?
Well, that goes back to my years living in Asia in the late 70s. I felt called to leave my university position, as described in the book, and go to Asia. And I was teaching there for the University of Maryland, Asian Division, and I had to travel about a great deal, and I had no car. I had to take public transportation everywhere, and I was constantly running into situations, especially in South Korea, which was a third world country at that time. So I had to give up on a lot of my presumptions. And I think I started imitating the Asians. I was so happy to be in Asia, and I think I just naturally took it in, embodied a way of being that was very different. I certainly came back to the U.S. a very different person.
I know. I've been to China, and boy, I double-checked every time I left my hotel that I had the card to my hotel so I could get back there.
so that you could show them to the taxi driver.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I know. I've been through that routine. Yeah. So I had to learn the first character I learned, for example, it's two characters actually. It means East City. And East City, the two characters in Chinese for East City, means Tokyo, because I had to get on a train to Tokyo. So that was the first character I learned.
You share in your book, The Divine Feminine, Tao Te Ching, that the writing originally made reference to mother, virgin, womb of creation, and at a certain point, these feminine references were replaced with it. Talk about that. Why do you think that was, historically speaking? What was going on then, if there is a historical pinpointed time that was going on? And
well, in defense of all the English translators who use the pronoun it for describing the Tao, the word Chinese character for Tao is not gendered. It's not male, it's not female. It is kind of appropriate. But on the other hand, as I went through the text, all the allusions and descriptions, for the most part, except with one exception, are using words like the Tao as mother, or the Tao as virgin, or the Tao as womb of creation. And this is pretty consistent. So I think other translators, and there are many translations of the Tao Te Ching, just went with the more conventional way of doing things. And, you know, I'm just a different person and a difference in the 21st century. And I looked at the words that describe the Tao. And in the Chinese, there is no gender in the grammar. So the translator is in the situation of choosing based on context. And the context for me was the words mother, virgin, and womb of creation.
Now, also, I saw somewhere in your writing that the other word that was perhaps used was origin. And now that is not mm-hmm. feminine or masculine.
Mm-hmm. The only other words other than womb, virgin, and womb of creation is character origin, which was also phonetically interchangeable with the character for father. So that's the one exception. I think that's in poem 21. So, you know, it's hard to know, because the character for origin, which we would translate as origin, or the character we would translate as father, were used interchangeably in the early periods of China.
I mean, it's reminiscent, really, of the Bible, for instance, like our father. Right?
Of course.
As the origin.
Of course, yeah.
Nobody, right. Everybody was connected even back then.
Right.
Very interesting.
Right. Yeah, it is interesting. It is.
The language is certainly unique unto itself, and I'm sure presented some challenges in translating, and you just mentioned a little bit about it, but what were some of the challenges you discovered along the way, and how did you go about deciding what to do?
Yeah, there were days that I spent, I spent sometimes days pondering a passage or a poem, and reading the scholarly literature, trying to understand the context for the poem. You know, there sometimes was a narrative base that's not so obvious. And I would look at the Chinese scholarship and try to figure out what was the original meaning as best I could discern. Something like that. There were lots of challenges. And, you know, some of the poems, particularly poem number one, I probably translated it about 12 times or something like that. You know, it's so complicated and esoteric.
Could you maybe read poem one so we can hear, and then tell us a little bit about what the challenge was there? That would be fabulous.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. So poem one. I think what I'll do is I'll read it out loud, and then I'll read the three stanzas again.
Great.
And talk about them.
Okay.
the Tao that can be told is not the everlasting Tao. The name that can be named is not the everlasting name. Nameless is the virgin of all things. Named is the mother of all things. Free of desire, we see subtleties. Not free, we see only things. The two, virgin and mother, are one, yet arise as two. A oneness called dark, dark beyond dark, is the door to all subtleties. So the first stanza, I'll read again and then speak to it a little.
Yes.
The Tao that can be told is not the everlasting Tao. The name that can be named is not the everlasting name. So in modern English, you could think of the first stanza as a disclaimer. In other words, you can't really describe the Tao. It's, it's ineffable, which begs the question then, of course, of why write 81 poems about something that can't be written about?
Well, only so, because it's what everyone in their entire lives is wondering, right?
That's right, exactly. It points to what we kind of intuitively know and not explicitly.
Yes.
Yeah, it's interesting.
You know, let me ask you a quick question right here, because what that brings up for me is, you know, in this day and age, we're all about defining, and we're all about knowing each detail and molecule and electron, and science has its place in my mind, and it served us well, but it's not meant to take over everything. And I wonder, from all of your reading from those ancient scripts, do you think they were more free with all of that and not so bound up like people are, or ideologies are these days, perhaps?
Yeah, something like that. I mean, I think the Chinese, would call that naming, and that leads me to the next stanza,
right,
interestingly
yes.
enough, your question, is that when you name things, you're trying to pin it down. And in a way, by naming things, one controls it. And a lot of science, and I'm a scientist, as you probably know from my biography, you describe it very, very carefully, and in a sense, that leads to control, manipulation and control. And that isn't what the Chinese Tao, in the Tao Te Ching, in any case, were trying to do. They were trying to point poetically to the ineffable.
Right, and do you think controlling is, or a need to control, I mean, we're getting off here, but the need or the desire to control, do you think that's a fear-based thing, or do you think it's a curiosity-based thing?
Oh, it's probably both. I mean,
true.
You know, we really want to know something, and of course science, as you said, has its place. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
It's just if we get attached to that kind of knowing.
Right. Okay, good. Next stanza. Thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome. So next stanza. Nameless is the virgin of all things. Named is the mother of all things. Free of desire, we see subtleties. Not free, we see only things. And this points to just what we were talking about. The virgin in the Tao Te Ching, as far as I'm concerned, points to the ineffable, the transcendent nature of creation. And you might call that God in Christianity or goddess in another tradition.
Yes.
But the virgin is nameless. She isn't pinned down. She's not named. But what is named is the mother of all things. And so you have these two aspects. In modern metaphysical terms, you talk about the virgin as the transcendent nature of the divine, and the named mother as the manifest, what you can see, trees,
right.
birds, one another, and so on and so forth. And this, of course, is what science works with, what can be seen. But if we limit ourselves to what is seen, we're missing the subtleties. So it is the mystic or the mystically inclined person who can see through to the subtleties of creation.
Right.
The more virginous aspects. You know, there's a reason this poem, poem number one, is put first. I'm sure there was editing in the ordering of the poems at one point. Most scholars feel that way. And the first one kind of summarizes the entire collection in a certain way. And then stanza three, the two, virgin and mother, are one. It arises to a oneness called dark. Dark beyond dark is the door to all subtleties. So it's not dark as in foreboding or sinister, but dark in the sense that you can't see easily beyond to the virginous aspects of creation.
Right. And do you think the following 80 help in that seeing? Would you translate it in that way?
Well, they cover a lot of things. I mean, the Tao Te Ching does address a lot of things, and scholars, and including me, can see that a lot of it is addressed to the king. It's about government. It's about good government. And the highest purpose of good government is peace. And we're very far from that nowadays, as, you know, anybody can see. You know, there's a fair bit of diversity, but poem one does talk about all the poems in a kind of essential way. That's all. It's a good place to start, anyway.
Yes, and finish if it's got to do with peace, for sure.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, I see the Tao, let me see if this question is even relevant anymore, because I see the Tao as a holistically beautiful writing of truth, and I kind of hate to even think about it being caught up in today's male is aggressor and feminine is not kind of mentality. And yet, you not only rewrote or translated in the feminine, but you translated as its origin.
Yeah, I chose to use, I could have gone either way. I could have used origin or father, given the Chinese text. And I chose origin for consistency, largely. And then in my commentary on that poem, I tell the readers that either one would be appropriate. That's how I handled that.
Right. Rosemary, do you have a favorite of the 81?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. It's poem number six.
We have time. Would you mind reading it?
No, I don't mind reading. The immortal Tao. Oh, no, excuse me. The immortal void. Interesting mistake. The immortal void is called the dark womb, the dark womb's gate. From her, creation takes root, an unbroken gossamer that prevails without effort. Yeah, this was a turning point for me, and that's probably why I love this poem so much. I have others that I love too, but this one, well, in a way I love them all, but this poem convinced me, was the turning point to choosing to use the word she rather than it as the pronoun for referring to the Tao. The immortal void is that great emptiness. It's pointing to the emptiness that is often usually thought of as a Buddhist concept, but it's actually in a lot of traditions. And that immortal void is called the dark womb, the dark womb's gate. And creation takes root in that dark womb and prevails without effort. It's like a gossamer, an unbroken gossamer. And the character for gossamer, for example, is a character for thread, a very slender thread. So this thread of creation is, in a sense, very, very delicate, but at the same time, it'll never go away. It will prevail.
Yes, not unlike a silk thread, right? Such
yeah.
a strong thread.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Creation will go on. The Tao will continue regardless of what happens to us. It's kind of scary, but it also invites us to make some real changes in the way we deal with the world.
Right.
Climate, for example.
Yeah. One big one staring at us, right?
Right.
Oh, beautiful.
Right.
Well, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's always a delight to talk about the Tao Te Ching.
That's great. And it's interesting, too, that you're a minister as well.
Yes.
From a whole other tradition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which only helps me.
Of course.
Because I can read a New Testament Greek, for example, when I've preached in the past. I don't do active ordained ministry anymore, but when I preached in the past, I would always go to the Greek text first before I read any of the commentaries, because I find if you go to the ancient language, you get, at least I get, I should say, inspired in
sure. In
original ways. And that's what happened to me.
Nice.
With the Tao Te Ching translation, of course. Yeah.
Thank you, Rosemarie Anderson, author of The Divine Feminine, Tao Te Ching. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, or sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasts are in your favorite places, and if not, let us know and we'll fix that. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.